is. So we'll let the Vortex roll. We grab a few minutes of time from the last show. Thank you very much. This is Bathroom Spears Broadside Civil Rights Report coming at you on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathroom Spear Robin Norris. We got guests calling in from San Francisco, coming in from Scotts Valley, and hopefully pouring out to Sam Farr's office tomorrow at 1 o'clock, third floor of the county building, telling that honorable representative to stop the bombing. Stay tuned. Is here. Not for us, but lots of people dying in Yugoslavia as we speak, as the bombing campaign in its 50th day reaches its height, or is it its 51st day? I can't quite keep track. We're going to be talking about that. We have a special call-in guest from San Francisco. We should be talking about that issue. She's an anthropologist. We had the pleasure here in Santa Cruz of having her on the Voices from the Village, a community television show that's also having another Yugoslavian show, a show about the air war, our air war, their ground war, I guess, in Yugoslavia. The Voices from the Village show today, if you're lucky enough to have Channel 71, will be from 7:30 to 9, and it's going to be taking call-ins at 425-4920. Fortunately, I don't see what the topic is. It's about the war in Yugoslavia, and I think it's going to have Norman Solomon and other people, some of whom spoke last night at the Veterans Hall Forum, which was packed with folks. That was about 250 to 300 people, looked like, crammed into the room. I guess the maximum was 238, so maybe it was a bit less. It wasn't... But it was really quite a crowd. Lots of people, all of them opposed to stopping the bombing. Now, if we can get off our academic butts and actually do something to show the politicians in Washington that we are serious and that we believe this is an immoral war that is being conducted in violation of the rules of war, without a declaration of war, by a huge conglomerate of military power such as the world has never known, against a small country the size of Tennessee. The actual area of Kosovo is the size of Connecticut, the portion of the over which this of the world of which this war is supposedly being fought under the pretext of human rights. And I welcome callers on all sides of this subject. We're going to be talking, of course, also about our usual subjects on the show, which are rights for poor people here in Santa Cruz. And indeed, I am really concerned that we not forget, while we are getting geared up to try to stop the military machine overseas, our military machine, or I should say their military machine, where we are an involuntary part of, that we don't forget that we have our own refugees, our own homeless cleansing program that is firmly in place, as best symbolized by the sleeping ban, the anti-homeless law that makes sleeping or covering up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night illegal in Santa Cruz, a law that prescribes a $54 fine for it, usually mounting up beyond that to about $150-odd with the warrants, as the warrants come out, involving a night in jail, possibly seizure of your vehicle, if you're in a vehicle. If you are caught with a warrant in your vehicle, you have to have your vehicle towed. You may not get your house or your living quarters, if your vehicle is your living quarter, back. Anyway, that is our own program that is undertaken by our own local government, our own liberal, progressive, Catherine Byers-run local government, Mayor Byers' sleeping ban, the ban that she helped to pass in March of this year that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep at night. That's happening here. We don't want to forget that. And the other kinds of laws and prohibitions that are designed to drive homeless people from public places, such as the downtown ordinances that make it illegal to sit down 10 feet from a shop on the sidewalk or to peacefully spare change after dark. Indications, straws in the wind, but the basis for a kind of tyranny over poor people, a kind of lawlessness where the law is the preference of the police officer, a kind of police state of our own where the discretion of the cop replaces the basic human rights that all of us should have, rich or poor. Call-in number for our free radio station, I'm going to try to keep my eye on that phone line. Looks like it's on blinker now, so I got to make sure I see that and it doesn't pass me by, is 427-3772. 427-FRSC, 427-3772. If you want to call off-air, call 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's the organizational phone number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and also my own line. So if you want to leave a message, talk off air about something, give us a call there, and you can call that number between programs. This is a twice weekly program. It's on every Thursday from 6 to 8, as it is tonight, and on Sundays on from 11 in the morning to 1:30. Now, I made a recording of the 2 hours of speakers last night, Norman Solomon, Bill Monig, and Constantine Dinopoulos, three speakers who talked about why we should stop the bombing, what's going on in Yugoslavia, what the media, the mainstream media, isn't telling us. And I played a bit of that earlier today, kind of cramming it in between shows that had some time. And hopefully we'll be playing more of that, repeating those speakers. In fact, we're going to be playing a little of Bill Monig today, if we have time. Monig was quite eloquent. It should, of course, be pointed out that these folks are all, they're sort of in the liberal part of the spectrum. They're not flaming radicals. They're not your kind of bedrock conservatives, who, ironically, in this war are opposed to the bombing without a declaration of war. I think it's a foreign adventure and violates constitutional protections and the powers that the president has and doesn't have. But there was, of course, a significant segment that was not represented as well on the left in this Veterans Hall debate, or I should say forum that we had last night, And I'm hoping that we can expand and broaden what's going on and who is allowed to speak, and hopefully that we can also move from beyond speaking to taking real action, to doing the kinds of things, such as I said, tomorrow at 1 p.m. on the third floor of the county building, 701 Ocean. Well, it looks like we do have an operational phone, where I'm going to invite you to come down and speak to Sam Farr, ask him some very serious questions. But let's catch that phone line.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Robert, just briefly, I was going to ask you to define, in your opinion, right and left.
Uh-huh.
And differences practically and ideologically therein.
Okay.
And I'll take it off the air.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Norris will proceed to give you a brief discussion of the terms right and left. Of course, that's always an interesting thicket to venture into. I kind of conceive of, when I say right, I'm usually talking about Republicans, and I'm talking about conservatives in the sense of conserving existing property relations. Frequently, where we're talking about property relations that favor large corporations or large aggregations of economic power, as distinguished from smaller people. I mean, for example, I wouldn't call a person a conservative, even though they're seeking to maintain the status quo, who wants to keep the beach flats, let's say, maintaining its current Hispanic population rather than giving that area away to the boardwalk in hopes of some urban redevelopment down the road. I wouldn't call that person really, in a way they're conservative, but I wouldn't call them right wing. I usually use that term with respect to large aggregations of corporate power, and that's what I'm thinking of. I'm also thinking of people who don't believe in universal suffrage in some meaningful sense. They don't believe in rights for blacks or rights for minorities or rights for women to the same extent as they do for those white men who are in power, or white male Europeans who are in power. Leftists, I tend to think, favor kind of not just equality of opportunity in many cases, but also to some extent more equality of resources. As you go further to the left, you get into kind of communists, both of the Christian and the Marxist stripe, and anarchists who believe that... I'm afraid we may be getting into a discussion on this one. Let's see what we got here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yes, my dad, I call me.
Yes, sign in, please. I want to make sure I have your name properly pronounced here. What?
Marie-Pierre Lai.
Marie-Pierre?
Yes.
And the last is?
Lai.
Lai.
Very good.
May I call you Marie-Pierre?
Sure.
Or would you prefer Marie?
As you want. What's easier for you?
Whichever you prefer. How about Marie?
Okay.
So, Marie, you're actually calling us long distance from San Francisco here.
Yes.
And you were here in town about a week ago speaking on a forum on Yugoslavia.
That's right.
And, well, let me just ask you, if you were talking to a stranger on the street and they said to you, what's going on in Yugoslavia right now, what would you say?
I would say that there is a big war, completely fabricated by the West since about 10 years now. This is the final plan to recolonize Kosovo and the whole country of Yugoslavia and make sure that the West can implement NATO bases in this country that was still missing a NATO base, because when you look at the geography of that area, all the neighboring countries have been receiving NATO forces or base, and Yugoslavia was still resisting, and I think this is the price they are paying right now, unfortunately.
Well, now, being the devil's advocate, isn't this sort of a rather costly maneuver for the West to do? I mean, in terms of expenditures to start, they spent 50 days bombing the country. Aren't bases in the surrounding countries sufficient? Why would they be concerned about having bases in Yugoslavia?
Because they're always afraid that the big neighbor of Russia could wake up. And so that's why it's important to secure that potential wake up one of those days. And we have also to remember that Yugoslavia is an area which has some potential resources that can also interest Russia, and that's why they want to secure that those potential resources as well as the skilled labor there is in this part of Eastern Europe is not going to be to the benefit of Russia, but to the benefit of the West.
Now, what specific resources are you talking about?
There is, I'm not a specialist of that, but I think there is a lot of minerals. There is also the road of oil that come from the Caspian Sea, and that can go through three directions, and one would be through Iran, the other one would be through, one of the other roads would be through Kosovo.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why not put it through Greece, or put it through, I don't know, go north above Yugoslavia, through Hungary and Germany, or through Croatia?
Well, the Danube is a potential, it's a potential transport. And it's one of the largest rivers in Europe. And that's one of the things they are trying to secure.
Well, of course, the NATO strategists who give out their daily briefings, President Clinton and my father, for instance, who's a supporter of Clinton's policy.
And yours too? we have that in common.
Yeah, I guess so.
You see?
It's amazing. Well, he's a survivor of, in his own way, of the Holocaust. I mean, he isn't German, he's American, but he looks at the, you know, the genocide against the Jews in World War II, and, well, hey, the genocide against the Serbs, let's talk about that too. And he sees a dictator using nationalism to stir up people and engage in what has come to be called ethnic cleansing. You hear this, I read today in the on the internet, looking at the LA Times news site, Clinton's claiming that 90% of Albanian population, what's called ethnic Albanians, I guess maybe he's afraid to say Muslims, I don't know what his problem is, but let's say an Albanian, the Albanian-speaking people in Yugoslavia have been forced out of the country, which I that's a new figure to me. I thought it was maybe 40% at most. Not that that isn't a horrendous figure, but it's always interesting when a national leader seem to give wildly exaggerated figures. But you know, here is a claim. Have you, and you yourself have been to Kosovo several times, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, first of all, I want to say that it's really a disaster what's happening for the ethnic Albanians, and not only for them, for all the other population of Kosovo.
Let me interrupt you just for a moment and ask you, when were you last in Kosovo?
I was there in January last. Yeah, I was there December and January of this year, and I was there for the first time in February 98, just before the violence erupted.
And your speciality is anthropology?
That's right.
And
you
were there as a visitor or as a worker? Or?
I was there as a with a non-governmental organization of San Francisco who has been working over there. And then, not being American, as my accent betrays, I was really surprised to see the importance of Western interest, and namely U.S. interest, in that province. And seeing also how they were interested to see what project we were working on and we were trying to implement at that time. And so when I came back and in San Francisco and saw the violence escalating, I started to follow up the conflict and try to understand it from the different point of view, from the different voices who were speaking then.
This was after you returned on the last trip?
That's right. That was in March of last year, about a year ago.
Oh, the previous trip.
Yes. And when I saw the media, the non-governmental organization, the activists, then all the observers of the Balkans speaking, I started to record all those voices and understand that my intuition maybe of seeing that this conflict between the ethnic Albanians and the Serbs was in fact only a part of the conflict. Of course, I'm not denying there is that, but this conflict is has been also, how can I say, has been generated and has been also sustained over the years by Western interests who really, I think, want to recolonize that part of the Balkans.
Well, now, you've said that twice, that the Western interests want to recolonize, but let's get some hard data here. How can you prove that?
Well, you know...
Let me be a little gentler. Why do you think that?
Because you have to ask that question because I think what the stakes for the Western powers. I think it's to redominate that area because it's a key region to control. It's the road of petroleum, like we said, from the Middle East as well as from the former USSR.
Which my father denies, by the way. Not that he's an oil expert, but...
Yeah.
We talked about the strategic side. I know it's also true, and this was a fact that, an allegation I read, which I haven't heard contradicted, that in 1989 and 1990, when Yugoslavia was sort of beginning this current turmoil, the United States passed laws that specifically said it would cut all aids and credit to Yugoslavia. And I guess the World Bank and the IMF either went along with this or initiated it, I'm not sure which, but it became a U.S. law unless there were independent elections held in all six republics.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of internal demands on a country's political structure really sort of set the scene for secession, and it was followed by the arming of the different republics as they, one by one, began to withdraw. Is this your understanding of what happened? Or?
Yes, I think, Yugoslavia, when the USSR dislocated in 89, and the Berlin Wall as well fell, at that time it was the moment where the West wanted to reconquer all those eastern satellite countries that used to belong to USSR. And you have to imagine that the Serbian army, according to the European standard, is by far the strongest army. So you could not attack Yugoslavia from the outside. You had to go from within. And this is why this whole media campaign that we hear of ethnic differences and religious differences has been
exploited.
It's been exploited,
mm-hmm.
And this has, of course, also had some implication on the economic level. And since Yugoslavia was a country from was a former socialist country, not belonging to the to Russia, to the Russian fair influence, they were granted the special privilege to have some IMF, International Monetary Fund, grants.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yugoslavia was sort of a third, part of the third world along with Indonesia and India, and indeed they buttressed themselves to withstand an invasion from Stalin in 1948, right?
Mm-hmm. But when IMF is in the country, they always arrive with their familiar austerity measure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those could only be taken by a central government and the leaders of the richer republic, which were Slovenia and Croatia, and those did not want to pay for the poorer ones, like Serbia, for instance, and Kosovo, in which Serbia was part of. So Kosovo, in the meantime, had also benefited from a federal funding to compensate its underdevelopment, which allowed the province to considerably improve its education and health system. So, for instance, life expectancy rose in 20 years from 48 to 60 years old. But after those 40 years of pickup, Kosovo still produced only 3% of the country's wealth, and the average income per capita in Yugoslavia varied according to the region a Yugoslav was living. If a Yugoslav was living in Slovenia, his average income per capita was 5,400. If he was in Serbia, it was 1,960. If it was in Kosovo, it was 525. And one can wonder why such a discrepancy. But I think we are here in front of the typical north-south gap that's the same that also shapes the global economy. The South provides the raw material at a cheap fixed price, and the North transforms them and benefits from the deregulation of price that is applicable only for the manufactured good and harvests all the profit. And what I'm trying to say here and to underline is that these economic differences are also at the root of the civil upheaval opposing the northern and the southern ethnic group of Yugoslavia that have triggered the dislocation of Yugoslavia. But this was done because there was a Western ingerence, a Western interventionism through the economic measures to weaken the country from within. So it was easier to come, and then the West again arrive as the savior, and through with UN, and then finally with NATO, because the United States as well as the other NATO countries wanted to make of that area a NATO protectorate since the very beginning. But Yugoslavia resisted so long that they finally had to go to the bombing. The first phase was, to my analysis, the first phase was through the economic measures. The second was through a media campaign that was supported by public relations firms. And it is now public knowledge that Ruder Finn in Washington, D.C. has been hired for the Bosnian-Herzegovina government, the Croatian government, and believe it or not, for the Kosovo leaders since November 92. And,
what is so the name of this group again?
Ruder Finn. Ruder Finn. R-U-D-E-R-F-I-N-N.
They're what, a public relations firm?
The public relations firm in Washington, D.C.
Well, is that, I mean, don't countries and nations do that? Have they been putting out false information is my question.
Well, what they have been really trying to do, and I have made some research on them, it was to really help the ethnic Albanian internationalize the question of Kosovo and build the public opinion against against the Serbs. And the demonization of the Serbs has been at the same time serving the Western interest. So what's very interesting is that documents that prove that Ruder Finn has been working for the Bosnia-Herzegovina government as well as Kosovo is on the U.S. Department of Justice official document. So that tells you how all of those things are linked. So when they tell us all the time all those pictures that we keep continuously on the first page of all the newspaper about the plight of the poor ethnic Albanians of Kosovo who are suffering, and I'm really not having compassion for them, I really regret it. I think public opinion has to remember, and I was there and I can prove it, that there was no ethnic cleansing before the bombing started. And there was effectively a war, civil war that was happening between the Kosovo Liberation Army and the force, the military and police forces of Serbia. And when there was some fight going on in a village, it's true that the houses were burned and then people were asked to leave, and you had effectively, probably before the bombing started, according to the numbers that are given by the United Nations, 250,000 people displaced and about 2,000 people dead, and that was covering both sides. But there was not a systematic ethnic cleansing. This has been the result of the NATO bombing.
But let me ask you this. What's the answer now? Of course, all of us believe the answer is to stop the bombing, but what then?
Well, NATO should get out of the Balkans right away, because this is what's creating the problem, and it's not what we are told it is. And I don't know if you have been familiar with that internal document from the German Foreign Office.
I've seen it, yeah.
Have you seen that?
I have.
You have talked about that on the air.
I have not talked about it. You can describe it if you'd like. We have, however, we're running out of time. What
okay.
We'd like to do, though, and I'm telling, let me kind of remind the audience we're talking to Marie from San Francisco, an anthropologist. I guess French is your native language?
French, yes. I'm French-speaking from Belgium.
And you have been in Kosovo at least twice, and you've become quite concerned, done a lot of studying on the issue. If you want to call us back in an hour, we can continue this conversation. In the meantime, what I want to do is, if you can't do that, or even if you can, feel free to, to spend a couple of minutes winding up what you're saying. And also remember, some of what you've said has already gotten out to the Santa Cruz audience through voices from the village.
Yes.
And you might want to add some things either now, or if you want to call back in an hour, that you don't think were covered in that particular broadcast.
Okay.
So, what do you want to do?
I can call back if you want me to.
I do indeed, and it's very illuminating to hear what you're saying. Please, let's pick it up.
I'm very happy because I really want to support those who give voices to alternative views to the mainstream media that is more and more trying to inform us to support the system instead of trying to give us an accurate report on what's going on.
War hysteria.
I'm happy to support you.
Yeah, and again, we've been talking to Marie, and give us your full name again.
Marie-Pierre Lai.
Marie-Pierre Lai.
That's right.
And Marie-Pierre, please call us back. And is there a number that people can reach, I don't know, an organization you work with if they want more information? Let's say they won't be able to tune in an hour.
I can maybe recommend an article I have been writing, which is on the website.
Okay.
www.coastalpost.org. And the name of the article is how Western interest, how the demonization of the Serbs serves Western interest.
Thank you, Marie, and call us back.
Okay.
And keep calling if you get a busy signal. We have only one phone line.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
On you gets your friends and neighbors too. There'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. Down by the old maelstrom, there'll be a storm before the calm, and we will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake, with complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. Oh, we will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a Te Deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. You will all go directly to your respective Valhallas. Go directly, do not pass, go, do not collect $200. And we will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes uranious, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
And that's the timeless lyrics, as my new guest just so appropriately put it, Tom Lehrer singing We All Will Go Together When We Go, composed 1960-61, still as macabre and fresh as the day it was written, and still as relevant and as true, particularly as the war rolls ahead. We're going to talk now about another war, about a quieter war. I have a couple of announcements that I have to make before we do. We're going to be talking about the case of Kevin Cooper, and in the studio with us we have Jackie Kramer, and we're going to test her mic right now.
Hi, it's actually Jody, but I respond to all iterations
anyway,
of that, yes. And I also respond to Judy.
Why don't we call you Jeff for short?
That's good. Or Joan.
So, and of course, someone has to call in to compromise our situation. Let's see who it is.
Okay.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Okay. Yes, this is Mr. T from my...
Hi there, Mr. T. What's the good word? What's the good word, Mr. T?
All right. Keep your chin up.
Well, thank you.
Plugging.
Yeah, well, you can feel free to join us tomorrow. We're going to be at 1 o'clock on the third floor of the county building at Sam Farr's office, telling him to stop the bombing. And that's,
okay.
If you can't come, we encourage you to give a call.
I sure will.
Phone number
and
to call.
What time is that going to be?
That'll be at 1 o'clock tomorrow.
1 o'clock tomorrow.
It's,
I sure will do that.
Phone number to call is, for all the rest of you listeners out there, is 429-1976, and tell Farr three simple words: stop the bombing and stop the bullshit.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. T.
I agree with you, and you go off at 8, right?
What's that? Sorry about that?
What time do you get off at 8?
I do indeed.
Okay.
I'll talk to you then.
Okay.
A couple of other announcements. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. As I mentioned earlier, Voices from the Village tonight, 7:30 to 9, is going to have more on Yugoslavia, and it'll be a call-in show, 425-4920. Calls will begin about 7:50. Also, as we speak, there is a forum going on campus, U.S. NATO War in Yugoslavia, up on UC campus, UCSC. The University of California, at the Student Center, second floor. That's the Young Socialists Forum, if you want to get the view from the left, or at least a part of the left. And the phone number, in case you want to contact people involved with the Young Socialists to see their literature, or hear when their next forum is, or get involved with what they're doing, is 502-5858. Also happening tonight, and there's lots of things happening tonight, it looks like, at the Pacific Cultural Center, the Santa Cruz Coalition to Free Mumia and Uhuru House is having I think it's about 3-hour long forum with speakers, a discussion, the video movie, the MOVE confrontation. That's where the Philadelphia police essentially massacred a group of black people back in the early 80s. And of course, as a person who's a part of MOVE is, well, the most famous is Mumia Abu-Jamal, but a number of people are still in jail as part of the guilty conscience of the Philadelphia police and the government there that burned alive the MOVE people in the early 80s. And if you want to see that, more details about that, hear about updates on that, and learn what you can do to help deal with and help with the people who are in jail around that situation, you can go down to the Pacific Cultural Center between, 6:30 to 9:30 tonight. That's 1307 Seabright, corner of Seabright and Broadway. And a phone number for more information in case you can't make it and want to learn more about it, or just if you want to get in touch with them, is 425-4467. 425-4467. All these numbers, if you miss them, give a call simply to 423-HUFF, and my producer will try to hook you up. If not she, then I will. Tomorrow, of course, I mentioned the 1 o'clock sit-in in Representative Farr's office on the third floor of the county building. That's at 701 Ocean Street. But later in the afternoon, from 4 to 6, there's a youth forum at Loudoun Nelson Center. If you want to go to that, that's another thing you can look in on. And hey, I could go on forever, but I've got a guest in the studio here, and she's looking patient, perhaps a little impatient, too. I'd be impatient if I were her. We're talking about Jody. It's not my fault. It says Judy right here. Jody Kramer. And Jody, I've actually looked over some of the literature that I picked up from you last night when we ran into each other at the Yugoslavia Forum, and did some reading. And of course, it's pretty grim stuff. A man named Kevin Cooper is on death row, has been there for, 14 years?
He's actually been incarcerated for this crime for 16 years, and he's been in San Quentin on death row for 14 of those years.
Wow. And it looks like he's an African-American, grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, had essentially a history of petty crimes, but not crimes of violence. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I'm not going to get into his family history or any of that situation, but he apparently was a homeless person who was camping in a house in San Bernardino County.
Actually, he had was serving 3 years in Chino Men's Penitentiary for a nonviolent house burglary, and he walked away. It was a minimum security prison,
mm-hmm.
and he walked away from that prison and made his way into an affluent white neighborhood in the Chino Hills area of San mm-hmm. Bernardino County, where he spent the night, unfortunately. If there was ever a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So he wasn't sort of just moving about from place to place. This was the first night he was out?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, and actually the next evening he left to hitchhike to San Ysidro and cross the border into Mexico, and that night, after he had already left for Mexico...
Three members of the Ryan family were killed?
Yeah, this family was butchered. This was the most sensational murder that's ever taken place in San Bernardino County. It occurred in June of 1983. Doug and Peggy Ryan were very successful, wealthy chiropractors.
Mm-hmm.
Their 12-year-old daughter, Jessica, was murdered. And a young man, Chris Hughes, who was just spending the night, he was killed. And their 8-year-old son, Josh, was left for dead.
Mm-hmm.
Phone records tracked the fact that Cooper had been in this house next door because he had called some people back in Pittsburgh trying to get some money.
Mm-hmm.
And because he could be placed in being in the vicinity, and because he was an escaped convict, he was a very convenient person to be charged with this crime. And of course there was great hysteria about this. People were very frightened and upset, and there was a need to arrest someone and charge someone with this crime expeditiously. In looking at this case, it's classic textbook of what it takes, or the formula to become convicted of a capital offense and to end up on death row. Cooper represents practically every element that's essential. First of all, the elements of it are being a minority, being indigent, abject poverty figures into it, uneducated, inarticulate, and without advocacy.
And killing someone who's rich and white.
Yes, a key issue here is the race of the victim. And when they're white, then you're much more likely to get the death penalty. If they're affluent, then the ante is even up. You know, there are 20,000 murders approximately, homicides that occur every year annually in the United States. They're all tragic and they're all grisly, and somebody dies in every one of those cases. But only 250 people get the death sentence on an annual basis out of those 20,000 homicides.
You know how many are actually so-called solved, or how many people are convicted of those murders?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But out of all of the trials that take place involving homicides, only 250 people actually receive the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And the two things that are the common thread that run through all of them is, first of all, their poverty, which prevents them from hiring competent defense attorneys, and secondly, the race of the victim. So we have gangs violence all the time. We know that Mexicans kill Mexicans and black people kill black people, and this goes on all the time, and none of those people receive the death penalty. So you really have to kill somebody white, and you really have to be poor in order to be sentenced to death.
And that, apparently, Kevin Cooper was, and he also had the thrill of having, what, two incompetent attorneys?
He's had a whole series of incompetent attorneys.
Sounds like the people I know at the courthouse.
Yes. Actually, he had incompetent defense until 1996. I think it's important to spend a few minutes talking about the problem of incompetent defense. When a district attorney is going to seek the death penalty, there's virtually unlimited funds that are usually made available for that. And that means unlimited funding for expert witnesses, for investigation, for a large support staff that does all of the work. Death penalty cases are very complex. So this huge machine goes into action, and it's very well-running and well-oiled machine and very well-financed. On the other side, we have the indigent defendant. And if getting an attorney who will even take these cases is very difficult. Most attorneys would rather do anything than defend somebody who's indigent and accused of a capital defense.
Well, I know as a homeless rights activist, when I've tried to get attorneys, very good attorneys who have been concerned about civil rights for homeless people, if they're involved in death penalty cases, it eats up all their time.
Yes.
All their time.
All
that's
of their time.
That's it.
Yes, because it's, again, very complex law. And what they are paid in the way of compensation is just a piddly amount compared to the work. So often the people that end up with these cases are people that are relatively new to the field. They may not have a lot of experience and know what they're getting into. Then they may not even get paid. Kevin's current attorney, his lead attorney, Robert Amidon, who has unselfishly devoted himself to Kevin's case because he knows that Kevin is innocent and has done thousands and thousands of hours of work, is owed by the state of California $250,000 at this point and hasn't been able to collect. Some of that money has been owed to him for over 2 years. So imagine a law firm that can take on a case like this and can afford to do this level of work and to not be paid for it. So the lack of balance in the prosecution versus the defense when you have an indigent person here is appalling. And you know, getting the death penalty is not like another kind of sentence or another kind of penalty. It's over. It's final. So when we're going to sentence someone to death, we need to have in place systems that guarantee fairness and that guarantee that the right thing happens and we find out who really committed the crime. And I'm, in addition to being an advocate for Cooper, I am above that, an abolitionist, and I'm working to end the death penalty.
Have you always been an abolitionist?
No. I got that from Sister Helen.
Sister Helen of...
Yes, Sister Helen Bajan.
Of the movie, the fame was, what, Walking?
Dead Man Walking.
Dead Man Walking.
Yeah,
movie.
After I read her book and realized that poor people are the only people that are ever sentenced to death, I thought that was outrageous. Then I went to hear her speak about a year ago when she appeared in Aptos, and I was very moved by her, and I thought, well, I can write somebody who's in prison, and the name I got was Kevin Cooper.
Now, had anyone done any work with Cooper in terms of, and you've done a lot of outreach here, I see you had a whole table of literature last night.
Yes.
Had any of that been written before you got involved in this
No.
case?
No, all of that has happened. Although he had worked for many years to try to reach out and to try to find someone that would actively work on his behalf. To do that, the first couple of years he was in prison, he was just absolutely enraged, as you can imagine. He's 25 years old. He's convicted of this multiple murders and sentenced to death in San Quentin. So he spent several years just being pissed off. Then he realizes that the only chance of getting out is to get his life together, to get educated, and to try to find some people to help him. So he turns his cell at San Quentin into a classroom. He stops watching all TV except educational TV. And, you know, you can have a decent conversation with Kevin Cooper about antiques, because he watches shows like Antiques Roadshow. So he knew nothing about his own culture. He didn't know anything about the civil rights movement or people like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. So he became completely educated about his own culture. Then he taught himself to type. And through watching television and reading the materials that were available to him, he began to zero in on groups or people, individuals that might help him. And with his newfound skill of typing, he began composing and typing letters, and he sent out thousands of letters in the search for someone that would listen to the fact that he's innocent. He's always maintained
his
innocence.
He's in San Quentin now?
He's in San Quentin. Everyone who's on death row in California is in San Quentin. There are 536 men there. Women sentenced to death are in Chowchilla.
How many women are there sentenced?
I don't know. I think it's under 20.
Interesting. I know part of what he wrote, was what he wrote, or was some of the literature you gave me talks about, it's an essay he wrote called Reality Check. He says, research on women of color in the justice system is limited, but the facts show that between 1980 and 1992, the number of black women in state or federal prisons grew 278%. There are currently more black women in prison than any other time in American history, and they fill the jails in greater numbers than black men.
Yes.
That's quite an astonishing statistic.
Yes. It's astonishing. The number about, the statistics about how many black people are in prison are astonishing. And let me give you two of them. The number I know about California is death row. Approximately 7-8% of people in California are black, and 39% of people on death row are black. Nationally, about 12%, a little bit more, of the population is black, and 55% of people who are in prison nationally are black.
And of course, the number swells immensely when you look at the number of black people on probation or parole.
Yes.
Or who have ever been involved with the criminal justice system. I think it's to a third or
it's
something.
It's a fourth of young black men are under the direct or indirect control of the United States government. Mm-hmm. It's growing. We now have 2 million people incarcerated. Last night at the presentation we went to about Yugoslavia, they mentioned the military-industrial complex. We have something else that's sinister and growing in this country, and it's the prison-industrial complex. And it involves the need to get more and more people in prisons and privatization of prisons. Well, you and I can own the Robert and Jody prison. And once we build it, there's such a need for prison space, we'll probably get a contract with the state.
The mom-and-pop prison.
The mom-and-pop
like
prison.
The sound of that.
Right. And then we're going to want to get as many people in our prison as we can get, and we're going to want to keep them as long as we can keep them in prison. And we're going to get to use their labor, because almost every major corporation in the United States benefits from prison labor. You name it. Revlon, IBM, travel agencies.
You know, here I was trying to avoid Chinese prison labor and avoid all products made in China, because they're so nice and cheap, and I thought they were being made by underpaid slave labor in China, but I guess I really want my own slave labor in the U.S.
Right.
To do the good work. I noticed some things, Jody. We're talking to Jody Kramer, who's an activist around, well, the case of Kevin Cooper, but also around the death penalty generally. I assume that's accurate.
Yes, absolutely.
A couple of things I noticed in the literature. Since the reinstatement of the death penalty in 1972, 75 condemned individuals have been released and exonerated, and Professor Larry Marshall of Northwestern University School of Law estimated 1 in 7 on death row in the United States are innocent. We get these stats thrown at us.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seriously looked into advocates on the other side on this issue who say that, I guess, Vanderhaeghe is a big proponent of capital punishment?
Mm-hmm.
At least he was 30 years ago when I was reading about it. I guess he may still be around.
Mm-hmm.
Ernst Vanderhaeghe, a conservative who writes for National Review. Have you ever debated proponents of the death penalty? Have you had intelligent conversations with them? I guess what I'm looking for is, what's the response of death penalty proponents to these statistics? Do they just say, "Oh well, you know, we've got to do something, and this is you know, kind of Old Testament stuff that we have to get back to," or what's the response?
Usually the reaction to people who are in favor of the death penalty is that most people want it, and so therefore it's justified. And it's much like saying, are you for or against the 49ers? If you ask a group of people, are you for or against the death penalty, many people will say, well, I'm in favor of it. But if you get people down to the individual basis where they're going to serve on a jury and they have to decide whether or not someone's going to be put to death, there are fewer people that feel comfortable doing that and being a proponent of the death penalty. If you tell people that how much it costs to have a death penalty, we spend $90 billion in the state of California, $90 million, excuse me, every year to have a death penalty. And it costs about $3.5 million to sentence someone to death, to execute a person, and only $1 million to keep them in prison for life. So when you educate people about the cost of that, and that we could take this $90 million and we could subsidize housing, we could build schools, we could open substance abuse centers.
Break down that figure for me. It seems contrary to logic and experience because, of course, is this figure so expensive because of the extensive appeals?
Yes, the requisite appellate process.
Well, then obviously what we need to do is just shoot them immediately, right?
Exactly. And to that end, we passed under Clinton in 1996 the Effective Death Penalty and Anti-Terrorist Act, which is, that's exactly what it's about, limiting people's rights to habeas corpus appeal and limiting the amount of time they have to prepare those petitions. And it's about, let's move them through this process faster, let's execute them quicker. And in California, because a lot of people wanted to, there are many people on death row and the cases take forever to reach the execution point because those people don't have representation, just recently opened in San Francisco the Habeas Resource Center. And that's a center where they assign these people attorneys with the goal of more quickly moving them towards execution. So there is that argument. The appeal process is what makes it so expensive.
Well, I'm glad that problem is being taken care of.
Yes, that we're addressing that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting also in this flyer you gave me, prosecutorial misconduct, a study conducted by the Chicago Tribune of homicide cases over the past 36 years in Cook County shows 381 homicide convictions have been reversed because prosecutors knowingly used false evidence or withheld evidence suggesting the defendant's innocence, but not a single prosecutor in those cases was brought to trial for the misconduct. I know that in our own headlines in the Sentinel, I guess this today or yesterday, we saw some stuff about local prosecutors, and it's very rare, being held, even accused of that kind of thing.
Yes.
A lot of us believe it's habitual.
Yes.
Particularly with poor people.
For the very first time, seven prosecutors are being in the process of being going through a trial in Illinois for prosecutorial misconduct around the case of Orlando Cruz, and it's. It's groundbreaking that this would happen. And I think, Robert, it's important to say to the audience, why do we have prosecutorial misconduct? We have it because we have the message that the prosecutor has to win. They have to win. They have to win in order to become the district attorney, to become the attorney general, to get a promotion. Getting a capital conviction is a crown and a jewel.
It's nothing personal, all you people being killed. Just remember, this is simply business.
That's right. It's business.
Yeah.
It's a way for me to get a promotion. And we've not, because these are supposed to be the good guys, we haven't put anything in place that punishes them for that. So they have a carte blanche card. Figure out, Robert, how to get the conviction. And in Cooper's case, a couple of really blatantly awful things happened. About 2 weeks after this murder, a woman came forward, called the sheriff's department and said she had a key piece of evidence, a piece of bloody clothing that she said had been worn by the person that was involved in this crime. The sheriff deputy, Deputy Eckley, went out and picked up the overalls, and she said to him, I don't want to talk to you about this, I want to talk to the homicide detective. No homicide detective ever called her, and 90 days later, Eckley got rid of the overalls in a dumpster. At Cooper's trial, he testified that he operated alone, on his own volition, in not turning the overalls into the crime lab or not logging them into evidence. Just recently, through investigation, and we raised money privately and hired our own private investigator, we've discovered an internal police document that shows that Eckley did this under supervision. This is prosecutorial misconduct.
In order to more easily convict Kevin Cooper's
yes,
murder?
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, I'm finding myself crammed today for time, but I want to. We have some more time, but there's some other questions I want to ask you. And I've been jumping around a lot here. So the situation was the murder was committed in 1983. Kevin was convicted in 1985.
Yes.
And he's been on death row ever since.
Yes.
Any developments in the last 10 years or last 15 years that are important in this case we should know about?
Yes, absolutely. Because we were able to raise private money and hire an investigator this last summer, and going through the evidence, which still exists in San Bernardino County, we discovered these autopsy photos. And in the hands of all of the victims, the four dead victims are clusters of blonde hair. It's obvious that this isn't Cooper's hair, because Cooper is a black man. So we know it isn't his hair. What has to be ruled out is the fact that this might be the hair of the victims. All of us who are working to save Kevin think that that's ridiculous. It's not the hair of the victims. But DNA testing is needed to establish that it's not the victim's own hair. It's the hair of the perpetrator. Those photos were never shown to the jury. This hair evidence, which has been in existence all along, was never shown to the jury. Another thing that the jury was told, but which was discredited, was that Chris Hughes, Josh Ryan, this one survivor of this crime, said that three white people killed my family. And when he saw a photograph of Cooper on TV, he said, "That's not the man that did it."
This is the 8-year-old who...
Yes, who's now 23.
And does he stand by that story?
Yes, absolutely.
And so is he seeking freedom for Mr. Cooper as
yes,
well?
Yes, he and his grandmother, who ended up raising him, are pressing for the DNA testing, which is essential to exonerate Cooper. There are 53 items of evidence, and testing those items will conclusively prove whether he did it or whether he didn't. In some states, like Illinois, after Illinois executed 13 people and exonerated 13 people, they passed a law that DNA testing is required prior to an execution.
How many states have that?
Only Illinois. We need it here.
Are there arguments that it's not reliable? What's the argument against it?
Not to my knowledge. And
or
in fact, it's getting more
prosecutorial misconduct. That would be the problem. Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And this is the point we need to make. Not that any of your listeners couldn't figure this out, but the state doesn't want to be wrong. They don't want these cases reversed. And in this most notorious crime that ever occurred in San Bernardino County, where this family was butchered, is the state going to admit 16 years later that they didn't get the right person? You know.
We all make mistakes.
Yes, we all make mistakes, but
Some of them just have to cover them up.
The system never reverses itself. In no cases of any of these people that have been exonerated in California or any other state, it never happened because of the system. It always happened because outside people like Larry Marshall of Northwestern University in Chicago, or Barry Sheck, who runs the Innocence Project in New York City, or Reuben Hurricane Carter, who runs a project where they try to identify people who are innocent, or Jody Kramer, because those people...